Hello and welcome to How to Medieval, the how-to where two guys show you how to do it between the two of them. My name is Ari.
And I'm Matt.
And today we're going to be talking about the elements of a good living history / reenactment event. More specifically, the medieval era, but one thing I want to get out ahead of is that this is going to be clearly a lot of high-minded general advices, because there is always going to be, well, this would work better for that kind of event, and that wouldn't work for this kind of event. And so the point isn't necessarily to spend 6.5 hours detailing how this one particular type of immersion event requires these elements, whereas that one type of battle reenactment event would require those elements. That's not the purpose here. The idea is to think of what is it that we expect that will help make whatever event you're doing more manageable, more enjoyable, not necessarily worth going to, but leave a really good impression. And I'm thinking about this subject now, as we have talked a lot in the past couple months about events in general, especially as, you know, we've seen a couple spikes and a couple different variants, but on the whole, it looks like we're well on the road to, for the next couple of years, being able to do a reasonable number of events. And a reasonable number is whatever works for you. Obviously, we talk about this in the fatigue episode, that however many you go to is a personal decision, but however many we host is really on the people who have the gumption to want to go and make events. And if you, say, are filling a void and you've never run an event before and you don't have the infrastructure of 25 years of this event being run and the guy who did it last is going to hand it down to you with all of their scripts and all of their experience, and you're wanting to bring something new to the field because your local group died or an event is gone and you want to do a smaller focused event in its place, what are we looking for in an event, and how can we, as the How to Medieval team, support you in trying not to necessarily make too many mistakes or faux pas or unintended, you know, things with unintended consequences that you just may not have thought about before.
And I like how you were wording this as a what makes a good event, because an event can be successful and still not be very good. It can have enough attendees so it makes enough money that it didn't lose money doing the event. I guess you could call that a successful event on some metric, but that doesn't necessarily mean it was a good event and would continue to go and draw as many people if it were to continue. So I like the idea of sort of the parameters of what's a good event. And then let's set those parameters. So what do we think a good event is, Ari?
In the most loosest terms possible, I would define a good event as one where everyone was able to enjoy themselves within some clear expectations of what to expect, and everyone went home safely. I mean, really, if you can hit everybody got what they expected and weren't disappointed because of they didn't know what they didn't know, and the people who showed up enjoyed themselves doing the things that they knew they were going to expect to be able to do, and then no one got hurt and no one died, like, that's a good event. Did it make money? I mean, it's necessary to at least break even, but is making money the point of a good event? No. Did you get a certain number of pictures? Did you make a certain historical discovery? Did you, you know, all these other things are things that couldn't happen or could happen at events. But really, if you have a group of people who come together for a specific objective, enjoy themselves, and go home happy and healthy, I think you've made a good event.
I like that definition. I like those metrics. I'll stick by that. It's there are a lot of good events out there, and they don't have to be big events to be good. They don't have to be flashy events to be good. One of my favorite SCA events, and I think it's a really good event, has actually struggled in the past to get attendees and competitors and people to try to run it. But when they do make it happen, it's a really good event. It's a really interesting premise of an event. It's called Artifacts of a Life, and it takes place in Connecticut. And basically, what if you're a competitor, what you have to do is create an arts and sciences display where you have put together or made connected objects that help tell the story of a certain like time of this person's life. I think it's a really interesting premise to try to create an event around. So, and yeah, like I said, they usually break even, I think, but it's just, I guess it's, you know, like, is it successful? I don't think it's overly successful of an event in terms of money and attendance and things like that, but it's still a really, really good event. And I really enjoy going to it when I can.
And that's why I strongly urge against relying on the Facebook concept of what makes something successful. So it doesn't, you know, when you think, oh, well, not a lot of people went to it, or not a lot of people were vocal about it on the internet. These are not the things that make good events. These are things that necessarily make good, like, conventions, I suppose. But we're not in the game to sell signatures. We're not here to make sure that the concession stand has a steady supply of people. This isn't a business. And so numbers really aren't the metric that I would want anyone to use for their decision-making on whether or not this was worth doing again or worth bringing back or worth starting in the first place. I have been working, I think I've mentioned in a couple of past episodes, about working towards an event in the local area that's meant to be a small immersion event. Honestly, if 12 people came, that would almost be too many, probably, based on the location and the goals I have set out for this event. So to say that an event has to be good because a lot of people go, then that means I can't, that would make it impossible to have a good or enjoyable or successful 5-person event. And sometimes an event needs to have a small number of people, because what is your intent with the event? So when I hear about the event that you're talking about, Matt, and it sounds like the people who go are thoroughly invested in what they're doing, and it reflects the interests of whomever shows up. And I mean, at some point, you know, we, being a niche hobby, we've got to acknowledge that there's going to be niche interests within our hobby that only appeal to a small subset of the people who participate. And by nature, if we are in a hobby that only appeals to a very small percentage of the global population, we kind of have to back up and be supportive and be an advocate for those interests within our hobby that only appeal to a small group of people, because that's what we have to deal with from the outside, is the fact that we're not universally appealing. So, you know, it's the idea that we would then somehow look down on or feel like we are less successful because a smaller niche within our niche doesn't have the entirety of our hobby attending those events seems a little backwards to me.
I'd like to backtrack for a minute, though, folks. I will sell my signature to anybody who wants to give me a dollar for it. I'm not above selling my signature. Ari put words
right
in my mouth.
Autographs. That's right. But I mean, if you get both our autographs, it's $2, right?
That's right. That's right.
There you go.
But so I guess what you can say is, so if you're somebody who's thinking about starting your own event for the first time coming back, a good foundation for you to have to start is setting up those parameters of what's going to make this a good event for you, or what's going to make it a successful event for you. That way you're not tied to, and you're not tying to yourself to what other people are doing. So it's like a good event for me would be, I've created this event, I want 10 people to show up. That'll be a good event for me. Then, and as long as people are having, enjoying themselves, then that's a good event. So making sure that you're going in with a goal of what's going to make the event good for you will help it become a good event for everyone else.
And I think that's great advice for the attendant of an event, but I would caution against being the person who hosts an event where the focus is what would be good for me. Because at some point, what's good for me has to take a backseat to what's good for the group of people who are going to be attending this experience. And so whether I'm not sure if I confused it or if that was what you intended, but I just wanted to make sure to clarify it, because I heard that there might be a way to misunderstand that one the other way around. We can't have events where it's in support of what is most beneficial to the person that's hosting it, because we, as much as we reenact the feudal system, we do not live in a feudalistic society. It's not about the masses supporting the person hosting the events here. And so when you go to an event, I think that is incredibly important to know that event is working for you. So even if it's an event where there's only 6 or 7 people, you know you're going to get what you want out of the event, which actually goes back to that first principle I was talking about, where if you are starting or hosting an event, the best thing you can ever do is make sure that your message is clear on what people can expect when they come to an event. And there's nothing that can be gained from being vague in your presentation about what's going on at your event. Now, at some point, that does require you knowing what is going to happen at your event. So if we're at a stage where you're ready to promote your event, but you can't clearly articulate what someone can expect to do when they get to your event, then perhaps we have not planned our event with enough detail to be able to support the people that come, because events don't happen spontaneously. You rent a field and get a bunch of medieval people there, and then poof, cool medieval stuff happens, right? You have to give them something to work on, and that doesn't necessarily mean a micromanaging itinerary where everyone is expected to do exactly this at exactly that time. But an event has to have a structure, and you see good events, like the really great events, have the clearest possible infrastructure as to what you can expect. So I'll use Days of Nights because it's, you know, my favorite event to go to, and it is a very simple premise, which is a timeline, do presentations to the public. So while it sounds like it's a just show up and do your medieval thing, it's also well supported in that the organizers of the events know where to place people's encampments so that the participants who come through, which are the public, are able to walk a coherent timeline, and they are diligent in grouping people by their time periods, and they do a good job of helping. Like, especially this last year, they had signs where you were able to put up, you know, your time period and kind of like the name of your group, and each person was given access to like a standards book. Like, so what are our expectations of your standards in your presentation? So while they didn't tell you what you had to say in your presentation, everyone who came as a presenter knew the guidelines that was expected for when they say things. You know, they were expected, they knew whether or not to talk in first or third person. They knew, you know, what the standards for open and closed tents were. They had all of the ground rules laid out for them so that they had the confidence in free expression of their own knowledge, their own fact, their own time period. And that's how you set those expectations up. No one goes there expecting a battle reenactment to happen. No one goes there expecting to go and be put on a quest, like a, you know, there's no way to confuse it for a LARP. There's no way to be confused as to why isn't there a, you know, heavy weapons list in an archery tournament and an ANS thing. You know, certain SCA events, you see that pattern where they have multiple competing activities at the same time that people can pick and choose between. But in this one, you don't have that concern because you know exactly what you're going to get when you get there. And so on the other hand, you see quality SCA events are very open with their scheduling and their itinerary, and so that everyone who goes knows whether or not they're going to have to pick and choose between two events, whether or not certain events are going to be going concurrently with each other or consecutively with each other. And the ones that people struggle with sometimes are the ones where that's less clear, and then they go expecting to be able to do two different activities, but then those activities are happening at the same time, and then they get disappointed.
That ties into what we were talking about, with the sort of event fatigue too. And I see this a lot in SCA groups where they're like, people go to an event and they're like, well, I want to go to the archery, but then I also want to fence, but I also want to do heavy. And it's like, I understand that event organizers, there's only so many hours in a day that they can fit everything into. And at some point, it does come down to the attendee to decide what takes priority for them, what they really want to do. And that can be really hard because you can love shooting archery and also love fencing. But if, you know, you really want to take part in one of the archery competitions that's happening during one of the fencing competitions that you really want to take part in, you're going to have to choose. You can say, okay, so maybe this year I'll compete in archery, but I'll only do the pickup bouts in fencing, or vice versa. I'll only shoot archery at the open times, but I'm going to compete for the rapier championship. And I think it's a good idea as an attendee when you're going to an event to help set you up for that mind frame of it being a good event, is going into it saying, okay, this is what I'm going for. If I have time to do the other stuff, I will do it, but this is what I'm going for. That way you don't get there, you don't spend half your time bickering with yourself about which one you're going to do, and then you don't feel disappointed for not doing the other thing. Because I do see that happen a lot, where people really want to do so many things, and they just can't. Because we all know, there's a joke in the SCA that everything runs on SCA time. So tournaments start late, they end late, you know, there's runover, court always runs over. There's almost no way to, there's no hard stop of, okay, well, it's noon now and the fencing competition was supposed to start at noon, but the archery competition isn't done yet, so we're going to postpone starting the fencing competition. It's like, it doesn't really happen that way. Things meld and overlap, and people need to be okay with making a choice. And I think it's become kind of hard for a lot of people.
True. And I think that is easy to make. It's easier, rather, to make that choice. Not that the choice itself is easy, but it's at least you have the option to make those choices ahead of time if the event organizer is incredibly clear about what is going to be happening during the event and what activities will compete with each other. So a good contrast to that, not DOK, because it doesn't have a set of structured events, except they've started to work on kind of a demo schedule, but that even then doesn't really compete with each other. One of the things, think of the Kansas City Sword Guild's Deed of Arms. The Deed of Arms is, you know, this big long event, and it has tournaments, it has classes, it has feasts, it has demonstrations. However, the event itself is catered towards people who we know ahead of time want to do all those things. So you got a bunch of people who are, you know, you think of like the chivalric feat of arms type of folks. They like harness fighting, but they also like HEMA. They like HEMA in funny clothes, more or less. And we know that they're going to want to play with the dagger work, and they know they're going to want to learn from the ring and instructor, and you know they're going to want to take a longsword class. You know they're going to want to compete in the list, or they're going to want to support someone in the squire's list. And so instead of cramming it all into a weekend and having competing events that people can pick and choose from, they pace the deed out for multiple days so that everyone both has time to go to and kind of decompress and rest from each one of these activities over the course of the almost week that the Deed of Arms was the last time that it was hosted. And so That is a contrasting way. Now, again, not everyone can make it for a whole week. However, they are, again, very clear, and this is something that they do very well, is they're very clear about which activities are happening when, up to and including having reduced entrance costs for those who want to attend only parts of the deed instead of going for the entire event. And so if there's something that you really want to do on a Saturday, but you know you can't be there from Wednesday to Sunday, well, you can get a Saturday ticket and come to just the things that you want to do and not stay for the things that you don't or for the time that you can't afford.
That's one of the reasons why I've never gone to Penzic, is Penzic, you can only buy your tickets in week chunks. So you can buy it for both weeks because it's a 2-week event. And for those who don't know, Penzic is the largest SCA, non-SCA event. Happens in Pennsylvania every year at the Cooper's Lake Campground. And it's just massive. It's a massive event. But anyway, so it takes place for over 2 weeks. But they don't sell day passes. You can only buy the tickets in a week. And really, there's only a limit. Even though you can literally do anything you want to do in the SCA, you could do at Penzic. There's only like two specific things I would really want to go out there for. One of them being the combat of the 30, which is a big 14th century themed deed of arms that happens. I've always wanted to take part in that, or at least see it in person. But I can't, and it takes place on a Sunday, but I can't just buy entrance for Saturday into Sunday and then head home Sunday. I gotta pay for the whole week. And I understand a lot of that is because, well, they don't want people coming in for one day and then just staying. And they want to know how many people are there and have the space for them there. But at the same time, it makes it difficult for me because I don't have the however, you know, $165 or whatever it is to pay for the week to be there if I'm only going to be there for a day.
Now, is that really so?
There's my gripe about Penzic.
Is there enough people who would sneak in with a day pass for a long period of time? Like, is that, I don't know. I just don't see that as being a huge problem because
I don't know. It may have been in the past. I honestly don't know. The problem with Penzic is it's one of the best things and worst things about Penzic is that it's not just SCA. It's open to everybody, and there are groups from all over that come and take part in it. Yeah, the SCA sort of runs the big show. They do all the battles and things like that. But there are groups that basically just come to party, and it becomes just a 2-week long party. So, and yeah, I don't know if there's a big contingent of people that would basically get their medallion and then stay longer than what they said they would. I don't know if it's been a problem in the past. I don't know if it's just would be more work, so they just, you know, more paperwork or more administrative work, so they don't want to do it. If you're somebody who has ever had a hand in running Penzic for the SCA, reach out to us. I'd love to hear your thoughts or and discussion and answers on why they don't offer a shorter amount of time.
Well, not just answering questions about that one specific issue,
the whole event.
The fact that we have consistently had people who understand and are successful at administrating a 2-week long living history style event. I mean, anyone who's done that in the past or is currently working on that and wants to like share what the back end of that is, because we have people who struggle to run a weekend event or get people out for a day to do something medievally. And, you know, the expertise involved in running this thing for 2 weeks, obviously it's clearly a team effort. I'm certain there's an entire staff behind it. There has to be. But if we have any listeners that have done that and want to come and share their experiences and give the people who attend this event insight into really what goes on and making it happen, I am certain that there's so much that the participants have no idea the amount of work that goes into it. I'd love to talk to somebody about that.
Yeah, me too, because Penzic is massive. I know that there's a staff that does it. I mean, Penzic has anywhere between 10 to 15,000 attendees every year. So it literally is just massive.
I hadn't heard that they allowed other non-SCA groups in, because I know that the SCA at other events can be a little touchy on people who aren't members being there, like different rates for them and insurance issues and stuff like that.
There is different rates. I don't know about the insurance part of it, but the insurance, they tend to be, it's an event and they tend to get event insurance and it's covered by that. But you do get a drop in the rate for being a SCA member. So mm-hmm. It's like if you're a non-SCA member, I think it's like $200 a week. And if you're an SCA member, it's less than that. I don't quote me on the numbers, folks. I don't have them in front of me. I'm just sort of making it up off the top of my head here. But so, yeah, you do get breaks on getting in. But no, I mean, there's groups. There's a group called the Tuchucks. They're a medieval-ish combat group. They tend to play a little rougher than most SCA people do, because they do fighting with grappling and things like that. I know people from groups from the Acre, which is another medieval SCA-like group, has a contingent there, and they go every year. And there's also, I mean, there's just people that show up, you know, in fairy wings and wander around all the time. So there's like Rennies, there's reenactors who come for different, maybe not the combat side of it, but they come for other parts of it. There's basically, I mean, anything that touches upon the medieval-ish, medieval-esque probably has some sort of presence at Penzic, because it's just now, that big. It's like Burning Man, but for medieval people.
Burning Man for medieval people, I like that. But not to insinuate that it's not a good event, because clearly it's a successful event that people go to and enjoy. But having never been to it, the idea that you have the Renfair crowd and other somewhat competing similar organizations to the SCA showing up at this big SCA event, that you have people who are completely unaffiliated with the SCA showing up to this event. I didn't know any of those things. And so how well are those expectations demonstrated ahead of time? Or is that the kind of thing that someone figures out when they get there, or having heard from other people who are there? And the question I have for the audience in regards to the crux of this conversation is, if those expectations are only word of mouth and it's not clear from the actual organizers themselves what you're going to get into, is that something that can be, is that a lesson that we can learn for creating our own events?
That would be interesting to learn. Because I don't know. Everything for me comes from people who have been going to Penzic for 20 years and telling me about it. The thing about Penzic is it's so large that it's easy to cloister your, it's easy to find the people you want to be with that share your goals and cloister yourself with them within the event. So it's experienced completely different every time, basically.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that makes sense. And of course, at some point, we should probably not make this a Penzic episode, because that wasn't the intent. Though such a large event is definitely worthy of future and more in-depth conversation, if nothing else, because it is so unique in that it is so large and so long and has grown into, as far as I understand, Penzic has grown into almost its own culture. It's almost its own beast outside of whomever is hosting it, more or less. And so definitely want to talk about that more in the future, but not necessarily to go too deep into the weeds on it today. So we talked about expectations as one of the parts of probably one of the biggest things that we have to do as event organizers to create a good event. Now, we can set expectations all we want, but if when people show up, they don't enjoy themselves, it kind of doesn't really benefit anybody in the long run. So one of the things we have to think about when we are evaluating whether or not an event is good or not is whether or not people come away enjoying what they've done. Now, it's not necessarily easy to say, well, if you do this, then they will be happy. It's, you know, we've seen major brands and events outside of the medieval era, the medieval hobbies, such as sporting events and things, where, you know, they seem to have the formula down, and still there's some days where you just can't get people to be into what they've even paid to show up to do. So trying to define what makes something enjoyable is difficult, but one of the ways we can really give ourselves the best opportunity to enjoy ourselves at the event is to make sure that what people expect lines up with what they get. And so we talked about this a little bit before about, you know, doing the groundwork to make sure that people get what they're going to, you know, think they're going to get out of the event. And another way to do that, not just by setting up expectations, is to create the infrastructure that is required to actually achieve the goals of the event. So, for example, if there's going to be some sort of tournament competition, to make a tournament competition, regardless of your rule set, fun, there are certain things that people are going to expect and that really resonate with people in any type of competitive atmosphere. You know, clear-cut rule systems that are decided on ahead of time and are understood by the participants, having some way of ensuring that the tournament itself is judged. So it doesn't really benefit making sure people come away happy if 10 fighters show up and none of them want to not fight so that they can adjudicate the tournament. And we all know that, sure, most people who fight are capable of refereeing, so to speak, but at some point, especially if it's highly competitive, you don't want someone calling the shots on a person who they may be fighting in the next round, because, you know, are they being fair? And at what point can people sometimes be worried about whether or not they're getting scored and judged correctly, unless the judges themselves have nothing to do with winning the tournament themselves? And then if it's a competition and someone does win, have you prepared some way of rewarding that? And does that mean that there are prizes there or some sort of accolade or a position of honor at the feast at the end of the day? Not everything has to be monetary, I realize. I realize that not everybody has the money to create cast golden pig sculptures or, you know, hand out, you know, expensive rewards for people. So I said pig sculpture. In my head, I was thinking of an aqua meal, but I talked faster than my ability to recall that vocabulary. but
please, God, somebody do a deed of arms with where the prize is a cast golden pig sculpture, please.
So complete random tangent. Just last night, now, obviously, you're listening to this, and it would be weeks and weeks ago, but just last night, we went to a new barbecue restaurant out in the Kansas City area near where I live, and it's called The Jousting Pig. And so all of the sandwich names and stuff have like vaguely medieval names to it, like The Jester and Fit for a King and things like that. By the way, The Jester is a fantastic sandwich. My wife got that one and I got a different sandwich, and I wish that we had each traded a bite in the beginning so that we could have traded the meal, because hers was so much better than mine. But not just because hers was better than mine. Mine was a fantastic sandwich and it's delicious. But obviously, the fact that we have a medieval themed pig themed barbecue place nearby that we had just eaten at may have influenced my ability to only think of golden pig idols when it came to. So I don't know how much that
one. I want to go to this restaurant now, though, I have to say. The Jousting Pig. So this can actually tie in. I mean, if you're having an event and it's going to be a day-long event, people generally have a really good time if they have food, if they're not hungry. So I make it clear whether or not your people have to bring their own food or if you're going to serve something. I think a lot of this boils down to what makes a good event is we keep coming back to that idea of just having clear expectations of either what you're doing or what you're going for or what's being done and how it's being done at the event. Clarity seems to people don't like being confused. People don't like not knowing what's going on, and they like having a feeling of being somewhat in control of what's going on. So having those clear expectations, whether or not it's by, you know, handing out the booklet like they do at Days of Knights, if this is what's expected of you when the public comes, or having that clear schedule of these are all the events going on at your larger event and these are the times that they're happening, so you have to make the choice to do it. That clarity is probably the baseline of what's going to make an event good for you, either as a planner or as an attendee.
So that's actually a great opportunity for another case in example is that if you're going to have food at an event, obviously people should understand that that's going to be there, because no one wants to come hoping that they could get a meal or buy a meal and then not provide their own provisions and then find themselves hungry all day. So who's happy about being hungry, right? Or the thought that they might have to leave the event to go get food because they didn't prepare, and that makes them feel like they didn't, you know, they just feel like they're missing out on something. And a lot of people, if they go to something that's considered immersion, you know, they don't want to get in their car in the middle of an immersion experience to go buy themselves a burger. However, you're talking about supporting people. If you're going to have a tournament, make sure the tournament is staffed correctly and rewarded correctly and administered correctly. If you're going to provide food, we have to give an honest thought as to what kind of food is appropriate for the event that you're providing. So at a non-immersion event where it's kind of just like a big market event, like people are just kind of coming and they're wearing their clothes because it's a good excuse for it, but they're mostly just there to shop. You know, there are events like that, and those are perfectly valid, good events, because it's nice to be able to handle some of the items before you buy them to see if you like them, instead of ordering them online and, you know, shipping them back and forth. But an event like that, you could have a hot dog cart, right? And that's not a big deal. You know, serve burgers from a, you know, typical concession stand. But in the middle of an immersion event, do you really want to see a wax paper wrapped modern American burger? You know,
that's basically what the SCA event Market Day at Burka is. It takes place. Actually, it would have taken place this past weekend or this weekend that we're taping January here. It takes place in New Hampshire during January, so of course it's done inside, and it's done in a hotel. A lot of people call it BurkaCon because it has a very con feeling to it, but it's still an SCA event where it's the largest shopping event this side of Lake Penzic, because they rent out the event center of the Manchester Doubletree or whatever it is, and it's full of vendors tables, and there's probably 100 different vendors in this one place. But you leave the hall there, and you're in the middle of a hotel, and you walk out, and yeah, you can go over, you can get a hot dog. They usually have like food vendors on the side there. You can get a hot dog or hamburger from, or you can go into their hotel bar. I mean, I always love the people, because it's a hotel, so there are people there that aren't members of the public, basically, and they'll walk into the tavern that they have set up there, and it's just a bar, and there'll be people dressed full of in full medieval gear. I can imagine it'd be like a weird, like, am I suddenly in like a D&D fever dream? What is going on here?
Yeah, you have somebody who flew in from Europe, and they're like, what? Did I get off the wrong plane? Anyway.
Yeah, basically.
But we have a similar event. In my mind's eye, I was thinking about Chris Kinder, because that similar event, it's, you know, it's done in whatever, November, December kind of time frame. It's like get your last year Christmas shopping medieval style done kind of event. And it's just there's no intent on making it medieval ambiance. It's just a medieval themed market that people dress up to. And in an event like that, you don't have to put nearly as the same kind of thought into maybe the set dressings or the food or even the type of events that you're going to set. Like, you don't have to coordinate marshals of different types of, you know, martial events, because those aren't the expectations. Those don't have a place in that kind of event. But if you're doing something that has much more of a medieval feel, you want to make sure that you have much more of a medieval offering if you're going to offer food. And if you're not going to offer food at all, like we said, make sure that the people know that, because there's nothing crankier than a hangry person, especially when they're a hangry person wearing funny clothes and probably carrying a weapon.
See, Berg is actually a pretty good example for this, because I'll be perfectly honest, I don't really like Burka. I don't like going to the event of Burka. And that's not to say anything about the quality of the event that the event organizers put on. It's just, it's not that immersion level or quasi immersion level that I like going to. It literally is, you're in a hotel, there's the marketplace, but it's in a hotel. There is fighting. they take over the hotel's ballroom, and it is a vicious meat grinder that is not, I never had fun fighting at that event, because it's literally, you're just walking through a meat grinder all day. But anyway, but a lot of people do like it, and it is like, what are you gonna do in the middle of January in New Hampshire? So you can't really do anything outside, you know. But my point is, while it's not my favorite event, I would say that it is a good event, because it is very specific of, this is what we're doing, this is how we're doing it, and they execute it very well.
Which I feel satisfies my criteria for making it a good event, especially since I doubt many people come home with an unexpected level of bumps and bruises, especially if they avoid the proverbial meat grinder of the hotel ballroom. And that would be the last element. Is safety is an incredibly important consideration, because while making money isn't necessarily the purpose of an event, like maybe making enough to be able to put on the same level of event with anticipated inflation and market cost increases the next year, you know, making a little bit of profit off an event is not something that you should be embarrassed about. That's if you are extorting your people, or for the purpose of buying yourself a new suit of armor because you hosted this event, well, maybe your motivations don't align with what most people expect event organizers to be putting forward to them. But if you're just trying to make enough money to keep the event going in perpetuity, then power to you. Like, I'm not gonna resent my entrance fee. But the problem is that you can bankrupt an event if you don't pay enough attention to safety, because even with insurance, at some point, if the insurance payout on something that happened at your event is $1 million, well, your premium isn't going to be nearly as cheap as it was the first time around. And so you have to make sure that safety is acknowledged. And I think, from what I've heard other people talk about when it came to like mistakes and mishaps they've done with public events, is that it's easy to remember safety on the archery field. Like, we are flinging small sticks of death, and that is immediately apparent that there are safety precautions required in doing so. But what people who aren't used to public administration necessarily don't, you know, sometimes forget about is, like, you have to be careful of like slips and falls on the sidewalk outside, because people can sue you for that. And we need to make sure that we aren't breaking maximum occupancy, or even we need to make sure there's enough toilets for the amount of people that we're planning to come. If we host an event at a park that has one, you know, pit latrine style toilet, and you manage to drum up 1,000 people there at the same time, you're going to have a huge, effectively a public safety health crisis with where are people going to, you know, put their waste when they're there. They're going to have to. It's the unfortunate reality of being biological creatures. So when we are creating these events, we want to be very mindful of the fact that the people who go can have all of their expectations fulfilled and technically enjoy themselves and not have a good experience because there are safety or health hygiene concerns that need to be addressed before the event goes on. So we have a duty to our patrons to make sure that they are healthy, happy.
For the most part, for most fighting events, though, they'll probably have you sign a waiver saying, if you get hurt, it's your own damn fault.
True, but they sign that waiver because we also, you can't sign a waiver and not at the same time have clearly established attempts at safety. Like, a waiver means nothing if you then go fight without a rule set and someone stabs somebody else in the eyeball because there was no one saying, yeah, your sword that you use shouldn't fit through a 3/4 inch gap, you know? And so the waiver means nothing if we don't put forward an effort to make sure that they're safe. The waiver is there if, despite all expectations of safety, you got bruised or hurt or broke a finger that's an expected, it's within the expected margins of error for swinging steel bars at each other, right? And
yeah,
but signing a waiver, you, we don't want to get to the point where we're expecting people to sign a waiver just to show up to things. And we can avoid that by making sure that the environments are safe, that there's enough room, that there's enough facility, that there's access to drinking water, or again, back to expectations, if there's no access to drinking water, that they know that ahead of time, they have to bring it. You know, I've been to events where they have water, and I've been to events where they didn't, and I was never thirsty because I knew whether or not I needed to port in a couple gallons of water with me. And it's not hard to overcome those problems, but we either have to address them first or make sure that people who come know that they have to address them themselves.
And then that, again, goes back to having a clear and clearly communicated information about the event and the goals of the event. So it all funnels back down to the clarity. It all distills.
It's all communication. To the clarity. You know, we just need to make sure we tell people what they're going to get out of things. And then, so we say, okay, if they know what they're going to get and they get that out of it, they're going to be happy, right? Well, maybe not, but at least you'll have put forward you've done your due diligence in making sure that they can get what they wanted out of it. Because someone could still show up and you can put in every single piece of paper in big gold, bold font at the top, no fighting. And they'll show up in their full harness and be like, so where's the fighting? Well, there's no fighting at this event. You guys suck. And not to single out fighters, but to be honest, the people who come with an expectation that their hobby is going to, or their subset of the hobby is going to be present, and then are upset when it isn't, are the fighters more than anybody else.
Well, that happens in the SC all the time, where there'll be like announced for a feast, and it will be like, it's like, okay, so it's time for the winter feast, and people are like, oh, is there going to be fighting? It's like, no, it's a feast. There's going to be eating and music and dancing. And they're like, oh, well, I'm not going to go then. It's like, well, okay, it's fine.
But that's great, because now they know ahead of time. But here's the thing, even if you do that, there's still going to be somebody who shows up and is upset that what they wanted didn't happen. But the event is still good, and the majority of the people will still enjoy themselves, especially when they know what they're getting ahead of time. And that's why we keep hammering on this issue of make sure that they know. And so that goes down to setting up a good event isn't just about making sure that there's good medieval pageantry on site and that there are clean toilets. It is vital to making sure that your message is heard. And I think there are lots of events out there that happen and nobody knows about them because we don't promote them. But those that know about them don't go because they don't know what they're going to get. And there's a huge difference between promotion and information. And if we can be more diligent about providing information, then not only will we get more people, but maybe more importantly, we'll get the right people to the correct events that align with their values and expectations and interests. And then the latent enjoyment of the hobby will increase, which happier participants, they're more vocal about it, they bring in more people, the hobby grows.
There's a group called Company of the Links Argent on Facebook.
I like
that. Yeah, they're out in the Oklahoma area, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
They have an event coming up. They've been doing a great job of promoting this event called La Campagne du Château 2022. The campaign home or something. I don't even know what that translates to, but it's
kind of like the home game kind of tournament.
Yeah,
they're hosting it,
and they're hosting it, and they're doing a really great job of trying to get out what it's about, and they've and promote it through Facebook primarily, because I think that's where most of them do most of their communications. But they've got it fairly clear, and they're very open to answering questions about it too. And I like how they've got that clarity, a clear idea. This is what the event's about. This is what we're going to be doing, and this is when it is. And it makes it easy. If I were closer to Oklahoma, I would actually consider going to it because it looks like it's going to be a heck of a good time.
Unfortunately, it conflicts with training that I can't avoid, but I was really hoping to go this year.
So whatever, either if you're planning an event, especially if you're planning an event or you're attending an event, remember that old John Lydgate quote. This is an old quote, fits perfectly. You can please some of the people all the time. You can please all of the people some of the time, but you can't please all of the people all of the time. And remember, if you're trying to please everybody at the same time, probably nobody's having a good time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's better to pick the values that you want this event to exemplify and use that to attract the people who resonate with those types of events.
Instead of it, they will come.
Ooh.
If you build it, they will come.
Double quotes. Two quotes in one stream of consciousness. I like it.
That's all I am. I'm just quotes, everybody. I don't have any of my own. I don't have any of my own material. It's all just quoting past me.
But I mean, that's all research papers are, regurgitating other people's information, right?
But no, you're right. You're right, though. At one point, you got to stick to your guns and say, this is what this event's about. This is what I'm doing. And people will either say, well, yeah, okay, fine, I'll come and I'll do it. Or they're going to be like, no, I don't want to do it. I won't come. So it's, you're right. You got to at some point just say, this is it. Take it or leave it. You'd be amazed how many people actually take it instead of leave it. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there's part of it's like, what is there on offer? And part of it is that people want to try things that aren't the same thing they've always been to. So a lot of times you'll get somebody who's vocal about liking a specific type of event, and then they realize this one isn't it, but they're still intrigued, and they'll go and they'll participate, and they'll see what the quote other side is doing with their weekends when they're not at the events that they prefer most. And then they'll go find one that fulfills their primary desires. And that's good too, because I think it's important that we support the niches within our hobby. And I wish I had the free time and the opportunity to go to events that don't necessarily, there aren't the things that I would always want to do, but I also want to see what is making other people enjoy medievalism that I don't necessarily get the same thing out of, because all of it's bits and pieces of our hobby. Like, they represent us as much as we represent them. And I would love to get to the point where I don't have to budget the time to only go to the things that I like best, and I'm able to actually also go to the things that other people like as much as I like the events that I go to. So
you can learn a lot about running an event just by going to an event you're not running and watching.
Mm-hmm.
And see, like you said, what are people enjoying? What are they not enjoying? What's working well? What isn't working well? And then you can come back and use that information to build your own event and try to avoid those, any pitfalls that you may encounter building your own event. If you have time, go to an event just to hang out, watch, pay attention.
I agree. I like that idea. So we've hit our big three. These are the reasons, I think the three aspects that will make the best event and make an event good. And all the internal details, as long as they follow this type of philosophy, as long as they are trying their hardest to make sure that the people who come get the things that they want out of it and that they're able to enjoy what are clearly explained activities while they're there, and that they can do so safely, whatever the small details of an event is, regardless of how niche or unique or expansive those are, you will have what is categorically a good event. And that's not because the event was hyper attended or super lucrative, but because it resonated with people who were there, and it keyed into the community that appreciated the activities that happened. And that's where we as event organizers should get the most gratification for the amount of work we put into the event, is to know that we've created a memory that people will cherish in the future and an experience that has added value to their life.
Yeah, I like it.
Give us 5 stars for more shows. Give us 5 stars for more shows.
Just give us 5 stars.
We'll do 5 episodes for every 5 stars we get. Or something like that. Or we'll do 5. We'll do 5-star quality episodes for every 5-star we receive.
And we'll send you 5 autographs for every $5 we receive, too.
There you go. But that does mean that we have to half sign one of our joint pictures.
Well, just send us $5. I'll send you a picture, and Ari will send you a picture, and you can tape them together.
I think we could do better than that. All right. If only we had a website, we could put up an autograph section.
Yeah, and always, folks, special thanks to Paul Butler for letting us use his music as the intro. His link to his website where you can buy his music is ever present in our show notes. And yeah, thank you for listening.
Thank you, everybody. Bye.
Bye.